Welcome, 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 everybody, to the Hockey Think Tank podcast brought to you by thehockeythinktank.com, a website for all hockey players, coaches, and parents to go for a little bit of education, a little bit of inspiration regarding the greatest game on the planet. We got a really cool episode for you guys here today. We have Mike Comito, who is an awesome NHL historian and just came out with a book that we're going to talk about a little bit. But before we get over to Mike, let's hand it over to my partner, who obviously is shirtless as I'm looking at him on Skype, Jeff LaVecchio. Jeff, what's going on today?
It would be weirder if I had a shirt on, probably, right?
I think like, you're probably right.
If yeah. I had a shirt on, you'd be like, why do you have your shirt on? Like, that's, you know. Anyways, I'm doing well. You know, we're recording the podcast at night. We usually do it in the morning. And the team I coach just had a game, and the boys played really well. Some injured guys came back and had really good games for us. So that was exciting to see them build some confidence and have some success.
Have some what? What was that?
Some sex. Is that what I said?
I think that's what she said, yeah.
That's a safe sport violation. Some success.
I like it. Well, we wanted to go over a few things first, just before we hand the podcast over to our conversation with Mike. And the first one is just a lot of gratitude to everybody that's been listening to the podcast. We just hit 15,000 downloads actually here tonight. And we're kind of blown away by the reception that we're getting from everybody. We're really, really glad that people feel like they are learning something from the podcast, from the feedback that we're getting, telling some good stories and making people laugh a little bit too. So really, really appreciate everybody for tuning in. And can't believe we just kind of did this to start for fun, to hope to educate some people. And we're starting to get a little bit of a following. So thanks to everybody for following along.
Yeah, thank you very much. Really cool. It's really cool. Tonight I was in the rink for a game, and I had three different people stop me and talk to me about the latest, you know, two, three episodes. And that makes me want to do it even more. Like, that's exciting. And people telling us, you know, we're learning something, because you and I are learning stuff too. And it's been really cool to share that and try and spread the knowledge so people can play at a higher level.
Yeah, definitely. And the funny thing, too, is like you get all these guys who are like, hey, like kind of indirectly, like, I think I'd be a pretty good guest for the podcast.
Oh, you know,
it's like we got a lineup, man. So yeah. We'll get to you at some point, hopefully.
Yeah, it's exciting, though, that people want to be on it and they want to share knowledge and, you know, think they got a good story. So yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, we also want to thank everybody for the last episode that we did with the listener, if that's what you want to call it, mailbag. We had a ton of fun just kind of talking between the two of us and answering some of the questions. The questions were great. And, you know, I think, you know, your story and my story and just talking about some of the personal struggles and some of the things that we've gone through and just sharing our experiences through the game is almost cathartic and is fun to talk about. So, appreciate everybody and the feedback from that mailbag episode too. You think we should probably do one of those again at some point, huh?
Yeah, I mean, the next day, like, people had listened already, and some of the kids or guys that were at the rink were like, you know, I got another question I want to ask you, and, you know, stuff like that, and thought that they learned a lot. And I got quite a few inbox messages on Twitter and stuff from people saying they really liked that episode. So pretty cool. I had fun doing that.
Yeah, definitely. So, and then, you know, one other thing that I wanted to talk about here before we headed over to Mike is, you know, today is Wednesday that we're talking to each other here for this episode, and it's not going to air till Friday. But, you know, a lot of times, I mean, Jeff, you know me pretty well. I'm somebody that kind of wears my heart on my sleeve, and it was a kind of a weird thing having to talk about an experience that my wife and I had that was really, really tough. And, you know, wrote a blog about it here today. My wife and I, for those of you who haven't read it yet, we had a miscarriage and lost a baby about a month ago. And, you know, again, one of the things that Jeff and I really want to do with this podcast is just like share our experiences and kind of let you into our thoughts and feelings. And, you know, this was something that it was a really tough experience. And, my wife and I wanted to share it with everybody because we do know from having friends and family, you know, having a miscarriage is something that's, it's common. and it happens to a lot of people, but it's really something that not a lot of people want to talk about. And so I think having the ability with the platform that we've kind of developed here to share my experience in how I've and me and my wife have grieved over the process, and you know, maybe there's somebody that's listening that can take something out of it that can help them grieve as well if it's something that they've had to go through. So appreciate the words. I mean, I think it's been a really emotional day for me. Again, the miscarriage happened about a month ago. So, you know, step by step you kind of take to heal a little bit and get better. And then today was, again, really, really emotional because everything kind of came back to the forefront. But, you know, the amount of just texts and calls and emails and stuff that I got from friends, you know, I learned a lot of my friends that this has happened to and haven't said really much about it, and they shared their stories with me. You know, a lot of people that just are in my corner, and I got to reconnect with the people that I haven't spoken to in quite a while. So you know, it was something where I wanted to share that with everybody, and if there's somebody that's going through something like that, I'm always here to help. Shoot me an email or a text if you have my number and stuff like that. So emotional day, but again, thank you to everybody who kind of sent some messages. It really helps a lot.
You're a great man, Tofsky, sharing something that personal. I know why. You just want to help the world with that one. So you're just a good man. Love you, brother.
Love you too, man. So with that, again, we wanted one more announcement that we want to make. So next week's going to be a pretty fun week for the podcast as well. One of the big debates in youth to junior hockey that people are always talking about is major, junior, or college. Which is the best route? If I want to play pro hockey or if I want to have a great experience, which way do I want to go? Which is best for me? And we talked to two people that are obviously really knowledgeable in that field. The first person we talked to is Mike McKenzie, who is the general manager of the Kitchener Rangers. He's also the son of Bob McKenzie, so we got some great stories from him and a great perspective. He played college hockey at St. Lawrence, then moved into being a coach with the OHL, and now he's a general manager of an OHL team. So we had a great perspective, and we'll be able to share with our listeners a lot about what major, junior, and specifically the OHL is about. And we also talked to Mike Snee, who's the head of College Hockey Inc., who is basically one of the biggest voices for college hockey, and talked a lot about college hockey, the path to college hockey, the state of recruiting right now, and two great conversations that I think people are going to get a lot out of next week. So I know, Jeff, you enjoyed talking to those guys. So that, what'd you think about just overall the major, junior, college debate?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a real debate because it's a pretty big decision, and unfortunately you have to make it very young. I mean, I think unless you're in that top 1 or 2% and you're that good that you actually think you could be in the NHL by 20, 21, maybe major, junior is a good route for you. But anyone who's not, which is what I would put most people in, for me, I think that it's always better to have longer to develop, and you can develop your body and kind of follow that long-term athlete developmental model and work out a lot. And then you get to pro and you're much, much stronger. Hopefully with that, you can resist injuries, you know, which is a huge problem, obviously, when you're trying to get paid to play, and then you have a better pro career. But everybody's different and everybody's path is different. But I mean, I think for those people who aren't like that, just like top percentage, not like on your team, not like in your city, like at your age level around the world, then, you know, I think college is better.
Yeah, and Mike shows great perspective with that, right? He talks a lot about that, have people having different paths. And, you know, he was a Canadian junior guy that went to go play college. And he talked about a great experience that he had at St. Lawrence, and also talks about a great experience that he has coaching at the OHL and being the general manager at the OHL level as well. So, yeah, great perspective from the people that you're talking about. I'm still waiting for my growth spurt. So when you talk about that, you know, maybe at some point in my life I'll get it, but probably not. So
I'm waiting to hit puberty. So, I mean, I'm right there with you. Hopefully one of these days.
Oh, God. With that, I think we should. again, we're going to have a conversation here with Mike Comito, and his book is called Hockey 365 Daily Stories from the Ice, and he'll talk about what the book is. Again, I read it at this time of year. We wanted to give our listeners maybe a choice if you still haven't gotten your Christmas present for your kids or for your siblings or anything like that. This is a pretty cool book that I think you'll like, and I think you'll enjoy Mike's conversation that we have with him here. So without further ado, let's send it over to Mike Comito. We're really excited to have on this episode of the podcast Mike Comito, one of the top NHL historians in the game. He's the historian for the Ontario Hockey League Sudbury Wolves. He writes for the LA Kings and does some really cool stuff there. And what an awesome, for any hockey fans out there, an awesome Christmas gift for anybody out there. He just wrote a book called Hockey 365 Daily Stories from the Ice, where basically he goes through and every day in the NHL throughout the history, something really cool happened. And so he talks about a story from every day. But Mike, before we get into the book, how are you doing up in beautiful Sudbury, Ontario today?
Well, it's a nice sunny day. It's a little chilly, but it's great. So yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. And you know, as we get going and talking about your book here, got the chance to read it, and very, very interesting. A lot of really cool nuggets about NHL history in there. But if you could just kind of give the elevator pitch of what your book is about and kind of how you got the idea to write it.
Yeah, no, I think you already kind of sold it well. It's especially at the holiday season, I think it's ideally the perfect Christmas gift for any hockey fan on your list. But basically, in a nutshell, Hockey 365 is 365 short hockey history stories, one for every day of the year. Each story is only a page, so it's a great book that you could pick up and put down. You can leave it on the coffee table. A lot of people tell me they're going to put it in their bathroom, which I'm fine with. You can put it anywhere as long as you're going to read it. I don't really care. But I should also note that it is actually, there's 366 stories in there. So you do get a bonus story to account for leap years. So it is a misnomer, but obviously 365 has a much nicer ring than Hockey 366. And really I think the genesis for the book came from my Twitter account. I've been doing hockey history moments on my Twitter account, for a number of years now, where every day I would kind of go back and, you know, curate some of the most notable moments that happened on that day in hockey history. And so after doing that for a few years, I kind of built up this database of all these different little nuggets per day. And I kind of figured, you know, there's got to be another use for this. And so, you know, kind of building off of the success I've seen with Word of the Day calendars or, you know, those flip away calendars, I figured maybe there's a way to kind of do that with a book and take the information I've been putting out on Twitter and kind of blowing it up a bit. So it's more than, you know, just 280 characters now, that it becomes a full page. And so that's really kind of where it came from. I've been writing about hockey for a while now. I always wanted to write a book, was my goal at some point. Didn't really have, you know, the idea of what I wanted to write about. And this kind of seemed to be the natural fit, because that's kind of where, you know, I'd really started to carve a place for myself out online, was with these hockey history tidbits.
That's really cool, Mike. What is your Twitter for anyone listening so they can, you know, get a gist of what you're putting out there?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So it's at Mike Comito, C-O-M-M-I-T-O. So that's where you'll find those daily snapshots in hockey history and anything else I write. I'll put it there.
Very cool.
Yeah, for sure. And he does. The Twitter feed is unreal. Like, for anybody that follows on Twitter, a lot of really just neat facts. You kind of go on there and be like, oh, I'm like, it's just things that happened in the past that you're just like, oh, that was really cool. And that just kind of gets you back in hockey mode. So, you know, taking a look at your book here, there's a lot of really cool stories, a lot of like really obscure stories too. You know, reading about, you know, the Detroit Red Wings back when they had Gordie Howe and Ted Lindsay and stuff going to play against inmates at a jail in Marquette, Michigan.
Yeah.
Like, that's just an unbelievable story. Like, what are some other kind of stories that people wouldn't really know about that you think is really cool in the book?
Yeah, there's definitely some oddities in there for sure, some quirky moments. Again, the Red Wings playing a game in Marquette is still at the top of the list, I think, for ridiculous moments in NHL history. But there's a few others as well. I think another one that kind of sticks out for me was when Gump Worsley was playing for the Canadiens. He went to a game in Madison Square Garden. He was egged by a fan. And so a fan actually brought in a bunch of eggs in a bag and started throwing eggs at Gump, and he hit him in the side of the head. And at this point, Gump's not wearing a helmet, and so he hits him pretty much, cleanly in the temple. He leaves the game because he's obviously a little bit dazed. But it turns out after the game, you know, he kind of laughed it off. He said that, you know, I didn't realize it was an egg until I felt the yolk running down my face. But and he kind of shrugs it off. But he did have a mild concussion. He didn't play for another 6 weeks. And so that's a story for me where that's just that kind of rises to the top in terms of another odd moment. There's other ones in the not too recent past where when the Rangers, you know, traded their first round pick to the Nordiques to acquire their coach. And it's still the only time that that's happened in NHL history where a coach has been traded for an NHL or for a draft pick. And so there's those things like that where, again, the story about the Gumper getting egged is certainly a weirder one. But I think even with the Rangers trading that first round pick for a coach, you know, that wasn't too far back. You know, that was 30 years ago or so. You know, there's tons of those moments. And then, of course, I think there's a lot of other more well-known moments that I think are kind of canon now in the hockey history world. But certainly I've tried to sprinkle in some odd stuff in there, some stuff that people might you know, take a second look at and say, oh, I didn't know that. That's great. And so that's kind of what I hope to get with the book, was kind of sprinkle in and mix in everything from the most well-known to the more obscure stuff.
I have definitely not heard the story of a coach being traded for a draft pick. Like, can we expand on this? That's nuts. What?
Yeah, so that was, I actually have the book in front of me, which is a good thing, because as much as I try to remember all the moments that I wrote about it, it has been a little while, and so it's good that I have it here, but I'm just trying to find the date. This is when Phil Esposito would have been the GM of the Rangers, and so he sends the first-round pick, you know, they're at the draft floor, and he goes up to the Nordiques general manager, and he's saying, you know, what would it take for me to get your coach? And he kind of thought he was joking, and he kind of shrugged it off. But I mean, after a little while of them kind of going back and forth on the negotiations, they do end up making a deal. And so the Rangers end up acquiring Michel Bergeron, who was, again, if any of the listeners remember him, you know, he had, his nickname was Le Petit Tigre, because he had this, which in French is the little tiger, because he was known for his, he was a small stature, but he was known for his fiery temper. And so anyway, they finally, you know, make the deal. The Nordiques get the first round pick. And this is back in 87. So the Rangers send their first round pick and $75K to the Nordiques. And so it doesn't end up working out. Quebec uses the first round pick to select Daniel Dore, fifth overall, the following year, or a couple years away. He only plays in 17 games, and it ends up turning out that Bergeron doesn't get along too well with Phil Esposito. Phil Esposito ends up sacking him, I think, into his second season, and ends up kind of taking over the interim duties as head coach. So kind of a wash for both teams, but certainly a more bizarre moment in NHL history.
So are you familiar with all the rules then? Like, can anyone be traded for anything? Because I'm sure you've heard the saying, like, oh, you got traded for a bag of pucks. Like, could I have been traded for a bag of pucks if they're out there trading coaches? Like, what?
Yeah, and that's a great question, because I don't even know if that would be allowable or permissible under the league's rules, right? I don't know if there was any. I'd have to go back and do some digging to see if there was any rule modifications or changes after that, right? Because we haven't seen it since. I mean, it is kind of a really bizarre move to do. So I can't imagine it would happen that often. But certainly, yeah, it'd be worth looking into to find out what are the actual parameters on whether or not a move like that could ever take place again, or would that be allowed?
It's like the Blues right now. Like, I'm sure they'd trade for anyone. Like, they're probably trying to get in like new water boys right now, trying to do anything they can do to change what's going on here. So that's pretty funny.
Yeah, and I mean, you figure it would still be allowed, right? Because again, even with you know, granting permission to talk to coaches, or after coaches, or you know, they sign with another club, you know, they'll send a draft pick over for compensation or something along those lines, right? So I guess in a perfect world, it'd be great to see that kind of happen more often, right? Especially anything that makes the NHL more into the Wild West, I'm sure the fans are on board with. So maybe there'll be another day when we see a coach get traded. Until then, at least we have that moment back in 87.
Very cool.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's bring something up. Actually, we'll get back to the book in a second, but something just kind of happened that's kind of lit the hockey world on fire here, and that's the Blues actually getting into a scrap in practice.
I don't know what you got to talk about.
You got the video that's out there, and you know, the two guys fighting in the Blues, and Jeff, you know, everybody's kind of going nuts and thinking it's this whole big crazy thing, but you know, for you, you've played pro hockey. You know, is it as big of a deal as people say? And is
come
it,
on, you know. You know,
well, I know. I'm leading you. I'm putting it up on the tee for you.
Yeah, well, I'm going to knock this one out of the park, because you know who I played for in juniors, and you know that in Omaha, playing for Mike Hastings we fought each other all the time. Like, he loved, I mean, I don't want to say like, you know, I don't want to get the guy in trouble. It's not like he would come up to me and be like, you need to go fight that guy in practice. But without saying it, he said it. You know what I mean? I got in more fights in practice. And I got to tell the story because I, you know, I tell this to the kids I coach and train. And, you know, when they're late, I'm like, look, like, I know you're young. Some of you, I know you can't drive yourselves. But I'll tell you a story. So my second year junior, it might have been my third. I was an assistant captain the year before. So I guess it was my third. And we had a golf outing the day before our first practice. Now, mind you, back then, cell phones, like, were just becoming a thing where everybody had one. They didn't have internet. Texting just started. That's how old we are. And there was no GPS. So we had a golf outing nowhere near where anyone would know. And we had a kid on our team from Boston named Pete Chelsea. Great kid. So he shows up late to the golf outing. He had no GPS. Like, he didn't know how to get there. I guess he should have left earlier, whatever. So the coaches were not happy. He showed up like a half an hour late. So we have our first practice of the season the next day. You know, nobody really knows each other. He shows up 1 minute early. I'll reiterate, early, 1 minute early. Well, that was not early enough for our coaches. And our assistant coach comes in the locker room to the veterans who are coming back, and they said, take care of it. And, you know, they didn't say go fight him, but we knew what it meant. So we're skating around. We just get on the ice. We're skating around, just doing the big circle, just looping around. And I go up to him, I'm like, hey, Pete, take your shit off. We got to fight. And he looks at me and he laughs. And I'm like, you were only a minute early. Take your stuff off. I have to fight you. And he laughs again. I'm like, no, Pete, I'm serious. I have to fight you. So he takes his stuff off. I absolutely pump him. And I'm not like, I'm tough, but I'm not a good fighter. Luckily, this guy had no idea how to fight. So I just pound the shit out of this guy. And I'm like, stay down. Coaches weren't even on the ice yet. Everybody, the new guys are looking at us like, what the hell? The veterans are all kind of like laughing, like, welcome to Omaha. This is what we do here. We put our stuff back on, continue to skate around. That's the first practice. So, like, fights in practice happen, at least when we were playing TOEFL, you know this, you saw them. They happen all the time. Like, me, I fought my best friend when we were playing in Japan because things got heated in practice. We immediately laughed about it as soon as we got off the ice. Like, battles happen. You're practicing against the same guys trying to get better. It's not that big of a deal. Like, obviously, because of what's going on in St. Louis, they're losing and they can't find a pulse, whatever. People are losing their minds. But, like, you know, I love it. As long as nobody gets hurt, which is the only problem I have with it, you don't want to get injured in a practice fight. But if it gets everybody going, that brings the intensity up. I mean, I'm sure you know. In your book, do you have any, like, stories about teammates fighting each other or any of that stuff or no?
Well, I was going to say, before I answer that, how early was he at the next team practice or function?
You know what? That guy was never late again, but there were a couple guys who were late multiple times and would have to get fought multiple times. But in Omaha, if you were late two times, the second time, you were probably on the block to get traded. If you were late three times, you were definitely cut or traded. Like, it was unacceptable to be late more than once. So, yeah, there was a lot of fighting on that team.
That's yeah, funny. But I was going to say that, no, there's not. I don't have any moments like that in the book. The only thing I could think of that would even be reasonably close to that would be I highlighted the moment when the Senators and the Flyers, you know, they set the record for the most penalty minutes in a game back in 2004. And Jason Spezza and Patrick Sharp fought each other at that time. Sharp was still with the Flyers, and Spezza was obviously the Senators. And so years later, you know, they're teammates in Dallas. That part didn't make the book, but I got to do a little deep dive for Vice Sports a few years back where I talked to them both, and they kind of joked about how, you know, they weren't great fighters, and I think they kind of laughed about it when they kind of became teammates in Dallas all those years later.
Well, it probably made them better friends too, though. Like, that's what people don't understand. Like, yeah, it's the heat of the moment, but, like, you're battling, especially, like, if your team's losing. Like, if you're a veteran guy and, you know, you're there every day, like, trying to get the boys going and try and get everyone better. If somebody slacks off or whatever, like, you know, you're trying to set an example. Like, you're trying to get everyone going, try and right the ship. Like, only thing I don't like is, you know, what if you break a hand? It's like, okay, that was so stupid. Yeah. But, you know, if it's just a short little quick fight and then somebody jumps in to break it up right away and nobody gets hurt, I mean, I like that.
Yeah, it happens. I think there's two things. The one that you talked about more, the policing and making sure everybody's on the same page and stuff. But also, like you said, like sometimes you're in a battle drill and it just gets heated, you know?
Yeah.
And you're battling hard against each other. And then, you know, we even talked about it on a previous podcast. Like sometimes a guy you go hardest against and maybe you fight him, those are your best friends. And, you know, I fought one of my roommates when I was at Cornell and playing. And, you know, just go back to the house at the end of the day and we're sitting in the same room, like having dinner afterwards, being like, man. And it's funny, he was way tougher than I was. And I remember like just getting all like really pissed off in a drill and stuff and then going at it with him. And then he hit me once really good and you kind of like sober up right there. You're like, your rage just leaves. And you're like, oh God, I got it. This fight's got to end. Oh God, come on. Somebody get in here, break it up. Yeah,
that's awesome.
All right, so yeah, it's just a little tangent. I knew I was gonna freaking get you going there. So
no, but I love it. I actually tweeted about it yesterday because the Blues fans have been going nuts all week. And Jamie Rivers, actually, who we were just talking about, Mike here with Sudbury, tweeted something like, you know, it's not that big of a deal. And then so I was like, yeah, like people were like, oh my God, like they should fire Bortuzzo or whoever was in the fight and blah blah blah. And I just, you know, I try not to comment on that stuff, but I was like, look, this is normal. And I tweeted at my buddy Wacy Rabbit, who I played with in the American League with and against in Norway, played with him in Japan. And we got after, you know, we're playing in Japan. Like that's not usually somewhere where you hear about fights. And, you know, we had a battle drill going in practice and he slashed me. I slashed him back. We tossed some mitts and we went at it. I just had a quick fight. I'll tell you what though, the Japanese guys, I don't think they've ever seen a fight in practice. And they were like, oh my God, these kids were so scared of me and Wacy after. Like the young guys are not kids. It was great. Their eyes were just like, what is going on?
That's so funny.
Yeah, all right, let's get Wacy, we're better friends.
Yeah. All right, let's get back to the book. Little tangent there. So Mike,
yeah, you know, it's all good.
Just going through it, I think one of the things that's pretty cool is that, you know, if you're a hockey fan, it doesn't really matter like where you live. There's something in there for pretty much every team. And I'm sure you could have like a 365 on like just like Wayne Gretzky or Gordie Howe or, you know, some of the other big names in the game. Mm-hmm. But you have a lot of different teams on here, a lot of different players. Just, you know, for instance, you know, Islanders fans, sorry, probably don't like July 5th. It's the day they hired Mike Milbury. You know, February 15th, just for another example, you got the New Jersey Devils, Marty Brodeur scores a game-winning goal. Just like little cool things like that. So talk to us a little bit about just kind of spreading your net really wide and how you got stories on kind of all these different teams.
Yeah, no, I think you said it best when, you know, and I kind of allude to that in the intro that of the book, that it could have been, you know, you could easily do a Gretzky 365 or a Bobby Orr 365. And so I was cognizant of that I, you know, again, and these are a lot of the stories that loom large in the hockey history world. So I obviously knew that I had to devote a significant amount of time to those guys because obviously of their role and their place in the game. But I wanted to make sure that I kind of spread the ice time around so that it wasn't always just every other day was a Gretzky moment, because certainly he had a lot of those. And so I made some conscious choices here or there to include his big highlight moments and his big milestone games, but not all the time. So again, I talk about when he passed his Gordie Howe for the all-time record for the most NHL points, but I don't devote a full page to when he scored his 802nd goal to pass Gordie Howe for the most goals in NHL history. And the reason I did that was because I wanted to account for something else that happened that day. Chicago's Bill Mozyanko scored a hat trick in 21 seconds, which is still the fastest hat trick in NHL history, which, again, three goals in 21 seconds is a pretty impressive feat. And so I felt that that was worth highlighting, but also because I talk about some of these other stories kind of link back to each other in different ways. So I another story in the book is when the Oilers acquired Marty McSorley from the Penguins. And so as part of that story, I touch on how, you know, later in McSorley's career, when he's with the Kings, he assists on that 802nd goal when Gretzky breaks the record, right? So I made a point to try to spread it out a lot. There is something for every hockey fan in there. The only team that I will say that's probably not highlighted are the Vegas Golden Knights, and that's just the reason, because it kind of came down to the timing that I wrote the book. By the time the first draft was submitted, you know, we were only a couple months into their inaugural season, so certainly they were you know, they're playing well, but nobody, I think, at that point really expected them to go on, you know, the incredible run that they did. And I remember actually by the time this, you know, the Stanley Cup playoffs were underway, and especially the Stanley Cup final, the book had already been, you know, finalized. We'd gone through all the editing. We were in the proofing process. And I just said to myself, my God, if the Golden Knights win the Stanley Cup in their first year and I don't have that in the book, you know, I'm going to get it from the readers. And so I was sweating it out. And then, you know, thankfully that didn't happen, because obviously that would just be, you know, that you'd have to include that in terms of a significant moment in hockey, in NHL history. But luckily that didn't happen for me. And I think that, you know, next time around, if there were to be a Hockey 365 Volume 2, there's certainly, I think, some moments there that I could pull from other teams, you know, that didn't necessarily get as much coverage as I would have liked. But again, you only have so many days that you can work with.
Yeah. So when the Vegas, when they didn't end up winning, were you, because you were so happy, were you partying as hard as the Capitals were last summer or what?
Well, I will say this, that I watched obviously all the playoffs in the final. I mean, and Ovechkin's been a favorite player of mine for a number of years. I'm a Leafs fan, admittedly. And so my team has never won the cup since I've been alive, and, you know, since the 30 years before I was alive. So, you know, for me, that was the closest I think I've ever felt to, you know, really kind of being connected to a Stanley Cup win, just because, you know, this is a player that, you know, has always kind of resonated for me. And so to see him win was great for me, but obviously it's not the same as, you know, hopefully one day it comes when I'll get to see the Leafs hoist the cup. But certainly I had a couple beverages that night to toast Ovechkin.
Nice. Well, I think the listeners will get a pretty good sense of your book and kind of some of the things that you're talking about right now. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you, as an NHL historian and going way back in the game, you know, one of the things I love about hockey is just how much it changes. You know, from not even from year to year, but just some kind of like seismic changes. So what are, as an NHL historian, what are like two or three things, maybe it's events, maybe it's people, that you really think change the trajectory of the NHL? Certain people getting hired, certain people getting fired, certain systems that were implemented, you know, whatever it may be. What do you think are a couple different things that really change the trajectory of the game?
Well, I think that in terms of, you wanted to look at, you know, the actual playing of the game, if you wanted to look at some rule changes, you know, I think certainly the adoption of the forward pass was something that obviously, you know, completely revolutionized the game from, you know, how it was played previously, you know, from the league's formation in 1917 until they finally adopted that in the NHL full across all three zones. That was 1929-30. It certainly changed the way the game was played, you know, how fast it was played, all these sorts of things. And so I think things like that were, again, you also had other leagues, though, that at the time they had the forward pass and they had done innovative things like what the Pacific Coast Hockey Association was doing. And it just took the NHL a little bit longer, you know, to kind of gravitate to that and bring it in. I mean, there's all sorts of other quirky rules like that, which I don't think are as seismic as instituting the forward pass and the red line or things like that. But I mean, even when the NHL first adopted the penalty shots back in 1934, the person that was shooting that you're taking the penalty shot, they had to do it from a fixed position. And so you couldn't skate in on the goaltender. You had the option of either, you know, kind of going up and taking a shot from this designated circle, or you could kind of carry the puck to the edge of the circle, but you couldn't leave the circle. And so, you know, these goaltenders were having to stop shots from, you know, from 30, 40 feet out. So it really wasn't too much of a challenge, right? And so they thought that that would make the game more exciting. And certainly it did, because obviously there's always a chance that somebody could score, but not quite like the penalty shots that in the shootout now that we kind of come to see the excitement with the NHL. So little things like that. I mean, they're always tinkering, I think, with the rules to kind of evolve the game. In terms of people, I mean, I'd be kind of remiss not to say that I think when the Kings acquired Wayne Gretzky in the summer of 1988, which again is a story that I covered in the book, because again, I still think that that's such an important moment in the league's history. Certainly the NHL had expressed, you know, interest in expanding at that point. They wanted to reach new markets in the late 80s. And so some of the plans for that were already laid, but I think really by having Wayne Gretzky and the star power that he had go to the Kings and, you know, become this Hollywood superstar, so to speak, and, you know, both on and off the ice, that really, I think, allowed, you know, the game to expand in the United States and reach new areas and, you know, and make new fans and all the, and really kind of allow them to maybe take the plan that they had that they'd envisioned where the game was going to grow. And kind of, they were able to take hold with that because of, you know, what Gretzky meant to the expansion of the sport in the U.S. and you know, the growth of hockey's popularity. So, I mean, I think there's certainly a number of rule changes you can go back and look at. The forward pass is obviously one, because, you know, it's no fun when you can't make a forward pass in the offensive zone. And so I think that was critical. Gretzky's trade in 1988 is obviously up there as well. So I think that those are two things at least that jump to mind for me in terms of seismic shifts and what they led to in the NHL.
That's really cool. That is a hilarious rule, the penalty shot one. That's, you know, that reminds me of, I don't know, did you guys ever play Blades of Steel on the old school Nintendo?
If you went to penalty shots.
Yeah, that's, if you went to penalty shots, that's what it was. It was a guy standing still, and then you aim the shot. That's hilarious.
I was once recruit. You know how they score the goal afterwards, and they have that little celebration where they all get in a circle and they do the.
So sick.
So yeah. I was recruiting once, and the team scored, and like literally all five guys on the ice did the Blades of Steel celebration.
That's the best.
It was one of the coolest things ever. But you talk about like forward pass, like that's nuts. How could you? I'm just trying to think, like, and Jeff and I are on Skype right now, so we can see each other. And when you said that, our faces both kind of went like, huh? And
yeah, that's one I've never heard.
Yeah, so, like, you literally couldn't, you'd have to, like, skate the puck up and pass it back. How did that even work?
Mighty Ducks, lots of drop passes.
Yeah, like, you couldn't pass into the, like, from the neutral zone into the offensive zone. Yeah, you had to essentially do a lot of lateral plays. Or back passing and things like that. And it was interesting because when the NHL was founded in 1917, at that point they started doing, you know, the winners of the playoffs in the NHL would play, you know, the champions of the Pacific Coast Hockey Association. So in that first year, in 1918, it's the Toronto Hockey Club is playing against the Vancouver Millionaires of the Pacific Coast League. And at the time, the Pacific Coast League allowed limited forward passing, but the NHL did not have any forward passing whatsoever. And so, and then also in addition to that, the Pacific Coast League also played with an additional skater. They still had the rover position, whereas the NHL did not. And so when they played the Stanley Cup final, let's say, they alternated between the rules for each game. So whenever Vancouver was designated as the home team, you know, they would play with the Pacific Coast rules, and then Toronto would have to put out an extra skater and play with the six man, and they'd also have to, you know, potentially do those limited forward passes. And then when they switched back to the home rules for Toronto, you know, Vancouver had to remove one of their extra players that they'd normally play with and play by the NHL's rules. So as you can imagine, the home team for each game had the advantage, and it ultimately ended up proving to be pretty decisive. Toronto won, you know, that first NHL era Stanley Cup on home ice in the last game.
Interesting. That's really, it's almost like the designated hitter rule of the American League and the National League, how the two different leagues have different rules. Well, cool. Well, I learned something. I learned a lot today. This was cool.
In your lifetime, what would you say two or three of the biggest changes were? Like, just from my playing career, for me, it would be getting rid of two-line pass. Because my first year junior, we had to play two-line pass, and that ruined the game. That made hockey way too hard. D-man would pinch on you. You couldn't fly the zone for breakaways. It was the most boring hockey ever. Like, thank God they got rid of that. And then the other one for me, like, as a player, I would say getting rid of, you know, I grew up using wood sticks. And then, the you know, when they brought in, like, the Z-bubble and the Focus Flex, and then obviously now the One Piece. I mean, for me, I think those are two massive changes to the game. What about you, Tove?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here. Changes in the game. You know what? You talk about, I think in terms of the NHL, they've taken away putting in the instigator rule. I think that would be one that, is pretty good. And then another one growing up that was different was the delayed offsides, right? So, you know how the tag up offsides is another rule that I think really kind of changed how you played the game in terms of, you know, now you can, you'd have to kind of take it back and make a play in the neutral zone instead of, you know, dumping it in and going to get it. So off the top of my head, those would and then obviously the rule changes after the lockout and what was it, 2004, 2005 season maybe, where they really cracked down on a lot of the stick penalties. And, you know, now it's more of a speed skill game instead of a, you know, big heavy type game. So hopefully I did okay for being on the spot. Mike, let's put you on the spot. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I think I'll probably take the easy way out, but the first one I was going to say is just even, you know, for fans that are probably my age or a little bit older than I am, you know, in their lifetime, they would have seen, you know, overtime come back during the regular season. And so the NHL previously had overtime up until 1942 during the regular season. They canceled it because we were in the middle of the Second World War, and they wanted to ensure that, you know, everything was scheduled on time, that if the games went late, you know, that wouldn't interfere with – with the resources that needed to be allocated for the trains. And so they scrapped that, you know, for the interim for the Second World War. But then ultimately, overtime doesn't come back until the 80s. And so, wow. You know, if you're a fan at that point, kind of growing up, this is a whole new experience for you, right? Because, again, you still have ties, but at least there was now an overtime period again in regular season. And I think now, just like kind of jumping off of that for younger fans, and you mentioned those changes following the lockout in 2004 and 2005, and even after the lockout in 2012 and 13. I mean, the way that they see the game now, you know, compared to what we would have watched growing up, I mean, with the addition of the shootouts after the 2004-05 lockout to now with 4-on-4 and now 3-on-3 overtime, it's just a whole different presentation of the game, right? And again, you get to see a lot of that speed and skill on display in 3-on-3, with there's so much more space now. So I think it's interesting, just even in the last, you know, this is the last 15 years, we've seen some pretty seismic changes to the game, to the way it's fundamentally played. So it's a great time for hockey fans. It's certainly very different looking sport from when I would have watched it growing up in the early 90s.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Mike, this was really cool having you on here. And again, for anybody that is looking for a Christmas gift that has some family members or some friends that are hockey fans, I highly, highly, highly recommend Hockey 365. Daily stories from the ice. And really appreciate you taking the time to come on and talk to us. And got to hear some pretty cool stories. And look forward to seeing some of the other work that you have coming up in the future, man.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I really appreciate you guys having me on, especially before the holidays, to give that book one last push for anyone that's looking to cross off those hockey fans on their shopping list.
All right, cool. Well, thanks again, and we'll be talking to you soon.